The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merritt, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to Sports Talk New York on WGBB Merrick, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here with you on this, the 14th day of September in 2025. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is with us as always, behind the glass, doing a bang-up job. Glad to have you with us tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in former Mets and Yankees pitcher, really a baseball lifer, Ray Burris, will join us. In the second half, we'll speak to an important author about his new book, Voices of Reason, Lessons for Liberty's Leaders. And we'll also discuss great speeches through the years in sports. That author is Robert Begley, and he'll join the show at 8:30. So relax, enjoy the show tonight. We got some great sports talk waiting for you, and I really hope you enjoy it. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow me on my Facebook page. That is called The Talk of New York Sports. There you'll find sports information, show information, great pictures. So stop by, take a look. You can also follow me on X at B Donahue WGBB, all one word. And if you miss a show, don't worry, because you can catch up on the website, www.sportstalknewyork.com. Catch up at your leisure. So our first guest, he spent parts of 15 seasons with seven major league clubs. He won 108 games using his sinker and slider repertoire. He was twice the opening day pitcher during the first half of his career with the Cubs, and he nearly pitched the Expos to a pennant in 1981 with two outstanding National League Championship Series efforts. After retiring as a player, he stayed in the game for more than 30 years as a coach, front office executive, and I'd like to welcome to Sports Talk New York tonight, Ray Burris. Ray, good evening.
Good evening, Bill. How you doing, my friend?
We're doing fine, Ray. I'm glad to have you with us tonight.
Thank you for coming up to me at the Hall of Fame induction ceremonies and getting to meet you and offering me this opportunity, Bill. I'm really looking forward to it. Baseball was a big part of my life, still is, and being able to spend, this is my 53rd year in professional baseball, and that's hard to imagine from a young man from Oklahoma and grew up on a farm, and it's been a real experience for me and a humbling experience from a standpoint of all of the players that I played with, the teams that I played for, managers that coach me, pitching coaches that work with me. It's been an array of names that boggles my mind sometimes, Bill.
Well, we're going to hear about that tonight, folks. Some of the great stories from, as I said, a man who's been in baseball for most of his life, Ray Burris. Now, Ray, as you said, you grew up on a farm in Oklahoma. Your family were sharecroppers. Tell us a little bit about that life.
Well, it wasn't the type of life I wanted to spend the rest of my life doing, but it was a part of my life as a young man growing up in the 50s and 60s that enabled me to understand the value of work. And I grew up having a great appreciation for working. You know, I honored work. I embraced work, because I knew that was the only way I was going to get things done, whether it was in the classroom, whether it was on the baseball field, the basketball field, court, or whatever. Nothing is easy in life. And working up on a farm, growing up and working on a farm, hauling hay, cutting wheat, barley, sorghum, raising chickens, hogs, cattle, milking cows, setting tobacco, that was true work. And I understood that I didn't want to do that the rest of my life. So education took over. I learned to hit the books and learn how to educate myself from reading and studying and going to my classes in college and high school. And as a result of that, I was able to excel on the baseball field. And even though basketball was my favorite sport, Bill, I love basketball.
You started
on the baseball court.
Sorry to interrupt, but I found it fascinating. I read that you started on the Duke High School basketball team as a seven-year-old first grader.
Well, that was in the first grade. I was a point guard in the first grade. Mm-hmm. I went to a school in the country called La Casa.
Okay.
In Hollis, Oklahoma, Bill. And we only had 300 people from first to 12th grade. So naturally there wasn't enough players that could make up the basketball team or wanted to play basketball. So I played with my older brothers in high school. I was a starting guard in the first grade because I could handle the ball. My mom taught me how to feel the ball as I was bouncing it using gardener's gloves.
Ah, yeah. Good way to teach her, yeah.
I mean, you learn how to feel the ball.
Right.
And I could feel the ball. They didn't let me shoot. They just had me to handle the ball and pass the ball. So that was my role.
Interesting. Yeah. As you said, in a small class like that, a lot of opportunity. And you learn to hit with a broomstick and rocks. Now, I believe it was Fergie. When I spoke to Fergie Jenkins, he started throwing when he was throwing coal, I believe, at a train. Is what he told me.
Yeah. I learned how to throw strikes from hunting.
Mm-hmm.
I would take rocks and hunt. We had a bird that we call a phylloch in Oklahoma. It had a yellow breast, kind of like a dove.
Uh-huh.
And we had plenty of jackrabbits and cottontails in the state of Oklahoma in the 50s. And I would go hunting with rocks, and I could hit a rabbit in the head from 50 yards, stun him enough to go up and finish him off with a baseball bat, and he was on the kitchen table that night for dinner.
Oh, yeah. Not too bad.
So it's amazing how good your accuracy can get when you're hungry.
Definitely. A very good impetus to learn that, Ray.
Yeah.
You're exactly right.
Yeah.
Now, also, when you were a young man playing baseball, Oklahoma was still segregated, and unfortunately, like most guys I talked to that grew up in the South, you encountered racism.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Over and over again. And the thing that helped me get through that was sports, because I didn't have a voice. It wasn't necessary. It wasn't in your best interest to be outspoken.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to channel my voice onto the basketball court and onto the baseball field.
Good way.
And yeah. I played with a chip on my shoulder. And that was my voice. That was the only way I could speak out.
You channeled it in the right way, Ray, though. That's for sure.
Yes,
you're right there.
Yes.
Now, Bob Gibson was one of your idols growing up.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I love watching him play, the way he went after the hitters, the tenacity, the no-nonsense, the intent that he went after hitters. If you know, when I watched him, he had a delivery that had a personality, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And that personality was speaking to me like, this is the way you go down the slope. This is the way you compete. This is the way you go out and show what you're made of. And I used the illustration of Bob Gibson, and I learned my delivery by mimicking Bob Gibson, Fergie Jenkins, Tom Seaver, Nolan Ryan, all of those guys. I learned how to throw the ball by watching them. Don Wilson.
Don Wilson, yeah.
Watching them pitch.
Don, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I got a chance to see in high school, I was a paper boy, and I would win prizes to go to Major League ballparks in the Astrodome in Houston right after it was built, and the old Kansas City A's ballpark in Kansas City, from winning prizes of being a paper boy delivery guy. And in those two trips, I won back-to-back years in 67 and 68, which is when I graduated from high school. In 67, I went to the Astrodome for the first time, and I thought that was, you know, how in the world can you play baseball indoors in air conditioning? That was like, you know, that solidified in my heart. This is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. This is the way you play baseball. I've been growing up on the outside in the heat and cold weather and all of that, and I can go and play baseball inside. Well, that solidified my dream and my approach. As I'm sitting and watching Larry Durker pitch for the Houston Astros and Roberto Clemente and Willie Stargell and Doc Ellis and Matty Alou for the Pittsburgh Pirates, that's who they were playing, and Joe Morgan and John Bateman and John Bacabella and all of those guys, Sonny Jackson. I remember them just like yesterday. I remember the game. I'm sitting in straightaway center field watching this game, and I'm watching Larry Durker from center field just painting like Michelangelo, just paint, strike one, strike two, strike one, strike two. And that began to shape my vision, my visualization in my brain. Then I went to Kansas City the following year, and they were playing the old Washington Senator. So I got to see Frank Howard, Eddie Valentine, Blue Moon Odom, all of those guys, Rick Mundy,
Mike Epstein,
mm-hmm. Sal Bando. I got to see all of those guys playing, and just watching them play, Eddie Brinkman. Freddie Valentine was the right fielder for them. And sitting there watching that game, it just continued to solidify in my mind that I need to excel in the classroom and allow myself to stay on the baseball field or the basketball court and see which one is going to give me an opportunity at another level. And that's how I approach my situation.
Outstanding, Ray. We're speaking to Ray Burrs tonight on Sports Talk New York. Man, Ray, the names that we're bandying about here, that was some era in Major League Baseball. I know I used to have the cards of those guys I was growing up, but that was some era in Major League Baseball.
Yeah. That was a pure era, my friend. That was baseball in its purest right there. And the names, the players, the way they played the game, I got a chance to taste that arena when I got into the league in the early 70s. And then facing some of those guys that I had seen coming up through high school and finishing off my career in college, that was pretty amazing to all of a sudden I'm facing Reggie Jackson. I'm facing Joe Morgan. I'm facing Johnny Bench, who's a former Oklahoman as well, who used to come up to Southwestern Oklahoma State College.
Binger.
And take BP.
Yeah.
And before from Binger. He'd come up and take BP, and I threw BP to him before he would go to spring training.
Wow.
So I got to see him and pitch against him, and, you know, that was the highlight of my career. Guys that I idolized coming up through college, and now all of a sudden I'm on the pitcher's mound and they're in the batter's box. Wow.
Surreal.
Surreal. Absolutely.
That is for sure. Now, Whitey Lachman. You remember Whitey Lachman?
Yes.
Was manager of the Cubbies for a while.
Yes.
He did mention that you resembled Fergie Jenkins in many respects on the mound.
Yes. When I got to the big leagues, you know, I was 6'5". Fergie is tall, 6'5". Mm-hmm. A lot of legs, me too. And so I could resemble and imitate Fergie's delivery. But in the process, I was also developing my style And, you know, I mean, you look at Fergie. There will never be another pitcher ever that wins 6 years in a row, 20 wins mm-hmm. in Wrigley Field.
No.
There'll never be another pitcher that can do that, Bill.
No. There'll probably never be another pitcher, Ray, to win 20 games, no matter where, the way these guys pitch today. Yeah.
Probably not, because they don't pitch enough innings.
No.
And so, you know, who will be the next 300-game winner in Major League Baseball? Probably never be another 300-game winner. The closest ones right now would be Verlander or Scherzer. But their injuries are, you know, compelling to not allow that to happen. So, or who would pitch that long? Who would pitch that long? I don't know.
There's no longevity anymore. There's no Severs, as you say.
No longevity.
There's no Ryans.
No.
Nope. Nobody like that anymore.
No.
The game has evolved is too nice a word to use because I don't like the direction it's going, right? But it's evolving. So much to away from those things, away from longevity.
Right.
They get paid too much. They don't have to stick around. The records are an incentive for them anymore like they were when you guys started out. It's a shame.
Exactly. I mean, that told the league and baseball what kind of pitcher you were when you could put 250 innings or more on the scoreboard after a 162-game season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your ERA told the league what kind of pitcher you are. Your batting average told the league what kind of hitter you were. And those are real numbers. They're still tabulating that. But, you know, there was a lot of pride. I took a lot of pride into going out there when it was my time to take the mound and go 7 innings or more. Every time I took the mound, I thought 7 innings or more.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned how to figure out a way to get through 7 innings or more and keep my club in the ballgame. That's pitching. I didn't have to throw the ball 102 miles an hour to get hitters out. I had to learn how to locate, create movement, which I had. I can locate my fastball and change speeds. That's pitching.
Right.
And in order for me to have gotten to the big leagues, I had to be able to command my fastball back in the 70s and even before that. So I could command my fastball. When I got to the big leagues in 1973, I had no changeup. I had no slider. I learned the slider from Ferguson Jenkins, and I learned the changeup from Dave Justy, a teammate of mine.
Mm-hmm. I remember Dave.
And he taught me how to throw the palm ball.
Do you remember your debut, Ray? Remember your debut at Wrigley?
April 7th or 9th?
8th, right in the middle.
April 8th, 1973.
Right.
Against the Expos?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, you relieved.
I remember my debut.
Relieving Bert Hooten. In the top of the second, two outs, runners on the corners. The Cubbies were trailing the Expos 4-0. And Ron Hunt greets you very rudely with a run-scoring infield single.
An infield single. But here's the way I look at that. I made him put the ball in play.
Right.
And I learned early on in my career in the minor leagues. Fred Martin was the minor league pitching coordinator for the Cubs at that time. And he said, he taught me damage control as a pitcher. If you got runners on third, if you're going to give up a run, get an out. So my goal was to always try to get an out. That means I wasn't trying to strike the hitter out. I was trying to put the ball in play to get an out. That's how you get create and handle damage control. And so that was the way I approached the game. I wasn't afraid of the hitter hitting the ball because that was my job, the ball in play. I had 8 golden gloves behind me, so I didn't have nothing to worry about. I just had him hit him in ball. Well, you know, Hunt happened to get that little infield single, but I kept coming at him.
Yep.
I kept coming at him. Yeah.
You ended
So Whitey Lockman was very, very instrumental in helping me get to the big leagues at my first spring training in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
I got invited as a non-roster player and made the big club out of spring training. And I have to thank several of my teammates who fought for me. Jose Cardenal, Glenn Beckert, Ron Santo, Billy Williams, because I would throw live BPs to them in spring training.
These guys taught you more than baseball, didn't they, though? They taught you how to be a major leaguer.
Yes, they did. Jose Cardenal took me under his wing and taught me everything I needed to know at that time in my life. And when I say that, you know, a lot of people say, well, what did he teach you? Well, he taught me how to save money. He taught me how to build my credit. He taught me how to try to pay all your cars off and houses off before you finish playing the game, because the insurance is going to be enough in itself. And he taught me how to be a professional on and off the field. And I'm still close with Jose Cardenal today. And I've always taken into consideration that the players who took me under their wings, it was my job when I became a veteran to do the same and pass it forward. And I was able to do that. And I'm very appreciative of the players who believed in me, the organization who believed in me and drafted me, the Chicago Cubs, and the managers and pitching coaches who supported me and gave me the baseball.
Right.
That's all I could ever ask for, Bill, is a chance to pitch. If I had a chance to pitch, now it was up to me to do it good enough to where that manager or that pitching coach would fight for me to get that ball again. That's all I ever asked for.
Mm-hmm. And you got it from great guys like Whitey Lockman. And the next guy I'm going to mention, Ray, want to ask you about him. Ray Burris is with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. 75, you earned a spot in the Cubs rotation. A gentleman I had on the show about a month ago. I was lucky to get him on, and he passed away last week. Jim Marshall.
Yes, I saw that. Yes.
And
yeah, Jim Marshall was my manager, and Marv Grissom was the pitching coach.
And those men, too, had an impact.
Those two men had an impact. Marv Grissom fought for me to be the opening day pitcher in 1975 from spring training. I had no knowledge of it because I'd been in the bullpen in 73, the bullpen in 74. And Marv Grissom saw something in me that I never got a chance to ask him what he saw in me, but he saw something in me that warranted them fighting for me, him fighting for me to be the opening day pitcher in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Rick Russo. We had Bill Bonham.
Right.
We had a four-man rotation. I think Ken Frehling was the left-handed pitcher we had gotten from the White Sox in the Ron Santo trade. So that was our lineup. And you know, of course, you know what Rick Russo did, and you know the kind of stuff Bill Bonham had. So I was right in the middle of that. Bert Hugin already been traded to the Dodgers at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Fergie had already been traded to the Texas Rangers. And Mel Pappas was gone.
Right.
And so we had a whole new renovation of the old 69 club. Had a lot of those players had been gone, you know. And
they had a fire
trades,
sale,
had,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So after the 73 season, you had Fergie left. Randy Hundley left, Glenn Beckert left, Ron Santo left. Santo went to the White Sox. Hundley went to the Minnesota Twins for George Mittelwald and Dave LaRoche.
Mm-hmm.
Beckert went to the San Diego Padres for Jerry Morales.
What about Kessinger? Kessinger go to the White Sox, Ray?
Kessinger went the next year.
The next
74,
year, okay.
Kessinger and Billy Williams left.
Right.
Kessinger went to the White Sox
the
after the 74 season.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Williams went to the Oakland A's after the 74 season.
Yeah. I remember seeing Billy in an Oakland A's uniform, and boy, does that look strange.
It doesn't look right, because all his career he's been with the Cubs. It doesn't look good at all.
Yeah. Now you
and then after the 73 season, Fergie got traded to the Texas Rangers for Bill Matlock and Vic Harris.
Another strange-looking uniform, yeah.
Yeah. different. And you know, he didn't have a good year in 73, and they thought he was washed up. Now he gets traded to the Texas Rangers, and he goes down there and goes 25-12.
Right, that's all.
And
yeah.
second in the Cy Young vote into Catfish Hunter from the Oakland A's, who went 25-12. Of course, they win the World Series. Mm-hmm. But, you know, 25-12, unbelievable.
Now, we're almost finished, Ray. I just want to ask you, going to the Yankees, traded for Tidrow, but they want to put you in the bullpen, too.
Yes, sir. They did. They put me in the bullpen. I never started for the Yankees. I was there for 3 months. And then I got traded to the New York Mets, where Joe Torre was the manager.
Mm-hmm.
When I got traded to the Yankees on May 23rd of 79, Bob Lemon was the manager for the New York Yankees. I get to the Yankees, and we're in New York getting ready to start a series with the Mets at Old Shea Stadium. Bob Kennedy is the general manager for the Cubs. I get a call at 9:30 in the morning at the Sheraton, New York Sheraton, in Manhattan, and am notified of the trade. Now I got to go to the ballpark, get my bag, which they had already packed for me, pack up, get to the airport, catch a plane into Minneapolis, where the Yankees are at. I get in there, I go to the ballpark, put my baseball bag in my locker, get dressed, and go out and introduce myself to Bob Lemon. And Manager Lemon said, Ray, he said, welcome to the New York Yankees. He said, look, I'm not going to use you tonight. I just want you to sit and watch.
Okay.
So I sit and watch. And I'm sitting there watching the game, Bill, and the Twins have a young man on the mound by the name of Greg Zahn.
Right.
Greg Zahn. Zahn. Z-A-U-N.
Right.
Left-handed pitcher. He's facing Reggie Jackson. He hangs a breaking ball to Reggie Jackson, and in the old Minneapolis ballpark, this was before the Metrodome and before the new stadium they got now.
Right.
They had a scoreboard that was higher than the Empire State Building in right center. It seemed that high. Reggie hit that ball, and it went over the scoreboard, and as it went over the scoreboard, it was still going up. I don't know to this day how far that ball went.
It may still
be
going.
But I guarantee you one thing. It may be still going. It may be the one that hit out of Tiger Stadium off of Doc Ellis in the 71 All-Star game.
Oh,
but
yeah.
That ball was crushed. You hear me? It was crushed. So now we're leaving the next day going to Cleveland. And Bob Lemon said, look, I need you ready for Cleveland. So I come in my first game in the American League for the Yankees in Cleveland. I lose. I get the loss, right? So I'm sitting in my locker, and Bob Lemon comes up to me and taps me on my right shoulder. And he looks at me. I said, hey, Skip. He said, look, you don't have time to wallow in your self-pity. Get your head right. I need you ready for tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, we got Tommy John pitching. He goes 7 innings. I come in after Tommy John to start the bottom of the eighth, right?
Yeah.
Lou Piniella hits a home run off of Sid Mungy, left-handed pitcher for the Cleveland Indians.
Mm-hmm.
We go ahead 4-3. I get through the seventh with no runs. They close it out in the bottom of the ninth. I get my first American League win. Now, here's what that moment did for me. Later on, when I became a coach, Bob Lemon showed me that he still believes in me and then put me back in the game the next day to show that. So what did that do for me, Bill? I was going to show him he made the best decision he could have made at that moment.
Right. Yep.
It made me compete harder. And now I was going to show him how much I trusted in him, because he had already set the stage. He showed how much he trusted in me. He didn't put me in the bullpen and let me sit for 2 weeks. He put me right back in the game. Mm-hmm. And I always used that analogy when I became a pitching coach. I never let my pitcher, as a reliever, sit and wallow in his self-pity. I went to him and I talked to him based on that one little incident that manager Bob Lemon gave me in 1979. Pretty amazing, isn't it?
A great story, Ray Burris. Well, Ray, it's been a pleasure. I'd like to ask you to come back because I'm not even half done with the questions I have for you. Will you come back?
I'll be more than happy to come back, Bill. Thank you for allowing me to be a part of Baseball Talk. And to all the fans out there, this is a wonderful game, and I'm very blessed and honored to have had a chance to play it for as long as I did and to still be associated with it for as long as I have. So thank all of you. Be safe, and go baseball.
That's it. All right, Ray. Thanks for taking the time, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Bill.
That is the great Ray Burris, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we're welcoming author Robert Begley. He's got a new book that we're going to discuss, and we're going to talk about some great baseball speeches. Stick around, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks. Welcome back. Welcome back to Sports Talk New York here. WGBB, AM/FM radio here in Merrick, Long Island, New York. Great to have you with us tonight. Of course, we know the Mets finally win a game today. The eight-game losing streak is over, and hopefully they can build on this and come back and win a couple more ball games before the end of the year. The Jets. What can I say about the Jets, folks? Same old Jets? No, we've been saying that for years. This is something horrendous that's been festering for years, and it's got to come to a head sooner or later, and some big changes have to be made. I don't think that'll happen until they sell the club. Well, we're going to talk to our next guest. He fulfilled his childhood dream. Fulfilled his childhood dream of playing center field for the New York Mets in 1991. Well, put me in, coach. I'm ready to play, right? He was with them for 1 week. He got paid. Wait a minute. The fine print here says he paid them $3,000. Oh, hold on a second. Is this one of those fantasy camp deals? Yes, it is. But he has a baseball card. He did run out onto the field in uniform at Chase Stadium. So that does count for something, folks, doesn't it? Well, he had a 12-year career at Merrill Lynch, which is something to be proud of. He tried and failed at other ventures, which we all do. Finally, he settled in as a professional speaker, a world-class speaking coach, now best-selling author of the book titled Voices of Reason. He's the founder of Speaking with Purpose, where he helps entrepreneurs, NYPD staff, and business leaders leave memorable messages. Today, we'll discuss the role of speaking in sports. We'll cover some famous speeches throughout history up to the present time. Then we'll talk about how athletes and coaches can leverage their careers by learning principles of effective communication through storytelling. Well, this gentleman has been known to throw around Aristotle's ethos, logicals, and pathos the way Keith Hernandez throws sarcasm in the booth, folks. Expect energy, storytelling, and maybe a Mets reference or two. Welcome to Sports Talk New York tonight, Robert Begley. Robert, good evening.
Good evening there, Bill. Did the Mets finally win?
Yes, they won a game today. The eight-game losing streak is over. And we're going to build on this and get to the World Series.
Yeah, sure. I want to hear that celebration speech by the manager.
Yeah. What do you think of that? I wonder what he said after today. I mean, you know, it's been rough. As I mentioned before you joined us, between the Mets and the Jets, there's just no way to win in life.
Well, speeches.
Yes.
That's an aspect of sports we don't always pay attention to, you know, and that's why I thought, hey, this might be a good topic for your show.
Why don't we start off, Robert, with probably the most famous sports speech of all. 1939, what happened?
Lou Gehrig, who they named the disease after.
Right.
Had stopped playing, what was it, like 1,200 and something games in a row. And he was diagnosed with an incurable disease, so he had to retire. And July 4th, like you said, 1939, he gave a speech, which anyone who is familiar with sports speeches knows that echo, you know, today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
Right.
And, boy, I get goosebumps just thinking about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was an important one, a great one, and kind of set the bar for a lot of people, and tough to compete with stuff like that. One of my favorite speeches, Robert, it's depicted in the movie Miracle, and
yeah.
That's the speech that Herb Brooks gives to the 1980 USA Olympic team before they go out to play the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you know that? I mean, it's pretty short. Do you know the, you want me to run it down?
Go ahead. Yeah. Give it to us.
So he said, great moments are born from great opportunity. And that's what you have here tonight, boys. That's what you've earned here tonight. One game. If we played them 10 times, they might win 9. But not this game. Not tonight. Tonight we skate with them. Tonight we stay with them. Tonight we shut them down because we can. Tonight, we are the greatest hockey team in the world. You were born to be hockey players, every one of you. You know why we're meant here to be here tonight? This is your time. Their time is done. It's over. I'm sick and tired of hearing about what a great hockey team the Soviets have. Screw them. This is your time. Now go out there and take it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, just classic. And Kurt Russell did such an amazing job in the movie, right?
Mm-hmm. Bill, if you don't mind, let's just pause and talk about the impact of these. The context was the Russians were deemed unbeatable. The Cold War was happening. America was just in this state of disarray and just everything was down until that game. I mean, what a big turnaround it was for, you know, for sports, for the U.S. and Lake Placid, upstate New York. And it just had real repercussions, and there's no wonder why they turned that into a film.
Yeah, it was phenomenal circumstances. I mean, you watch the film and you watch the Soviet coach. They don't know what to do at the end of the game because they've never been in that situation before. Why didn't they pull the goalie? They didn't pull the goalie because they didn't know how to pull the goalie. They've never had to do that before.
Right.
And just as I said, amazing circumstances, amazing speech. Kurt Russell really played a great part in that film, playing Herbie.
Yeah. Yeah, he absolutely did. And if we could backpedal to the Gehrig talk, just two brief points I'd like to make.
Sure.
One is that this speech was so inspiring to me as a kid. I grew up right near Yankee Stadium. Do you remember those telephones that you could listen to? You could pick them up in the old stadium, and you'd hear the voices of all these old-time heroes.
Yeah.
They had them in the ground room, these red phones. I would play that over and over again. And you mentioned me working at Merrill Lynch 12 years. Well, guess what? 12 years I had a perfect attendance record, and Lou Gehrig was on my mind. So here's what some man's speech and actions can do to a little boy when years later he's working for a business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, you're exactly right, Robert. You were the Iron Man.
That's true. I was the Iron Man.
Yeah.
And then do you remember Norm MacDonald on Saturday Night Live? He came out and did the skit about Lou Gehrig. He had the Lou Gehrig uniform, and he goes, "What did he say? The hardest part about dying, Wait, no, that I'm not the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
Yeah.
That was being sarcastic, you know. I'm going to die.
Yeah, right. Oh man. Yeah, you were the Iron Man, and I believe what we spoke about a couple of minutes ago. I think it was 2,130 games. I didn't look it up, but I think that number rings a bell with me.
Thank you, Bill. Yeah, way more than 1,000. You're right.
Yeah.
And while I was at Merrill, Cal was when Cal Ripken beat Lou Gehrig's streak. So
yeah.
Some records are, you know, you'd think they'd never be broken, but that one. Amazing. But Ripken didn't die a couple of weeks after.
No.
Like, so that does say something about Gehrig's record.
Yeah. It was, like we said, the circumstances were mm-hmm. amazing with Lou. And he, mm-hmm. he had the good fortune to pass away and make himself a legend. He's buried up in Kanisco Cemetery up
yeah.
in Westchester County. You could go visit.
Yeah.
I believe his ashes are gone. To prevent an overzealous Yankee fan from getting a great souvenir. A family member has his ashes, but there is a stone erected to Lou, and so many great people in that cemetery. Danny Kaye, your girl Ayn Rand is
there. Ayn Rand is there. Sergei Rachmaninoff, you're right. Cemetery, yeah.
Some great names, that's for sure. But we digress, Robert. I know this next speech, Robert Begley with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. Davey Johnson's speech, 1986 Mets preseason. What does he do?
Well, the two prior years, 84 and 85, they had a really good team. You remember that. I mean, once Johnson became the manager, first thing he said was, why'd you wait so long to hire me? And both 84 and 85, I think they made it down to like the last weekend, maybe the last week. But in 86, they were ready. And all he said was, we are going to win it all. We are going to dominate.
Right.
And boy, was he right. You don't need to say much more than that. You know, we're just going to dominate.
Yeah, and they did.
And they did. I remember Whitey Herzog, the reigning champ of the St. Louis Cardinals. It was late May, and he's even admitted it's all over with that pitching staff and that hitting. He's like, that's all over. But Davey Johnson, you know, recently passed away, and a lot of things have been coming out about him. What a man, what a leader, and that's one of the things leaders do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a true leader of that ball club. He treated the guys like men, which some people
yes.
may have said with some of those guys it was a mistake. But it sure worked in 86, and he got the most out of those guys.
You're right.
Right?
You're totally right. Yeah, some of them were overgrown adolescents, but not full-grown men, but, you know, that's what a manager does.
Right. I can't imagine that team being led by George Bamberger or even Frank Howard. It needed somebody special, and that was Davey.
Yeah.
He took it to the limit, and that
yeah.
is for sure. Now,
mm-hmm.
Where do you want to go next? Who do you want to talk about next?
Well, let's go. Let's stay with baseball.
Okay.
You know, Ichiro just got into the Hall of Fame.
Great one. Yeah.
Gave a really good speech. And one of the interesting things is we never really heard him speak because as a Japanese player, he would always have a translator with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of one of the things that bothered me a little bit because I want to hear the man's voice. If you won the game, I want to hear it from your mouth.
Yeah.
But I don't know if there are some kind of rules or something with translators. I think Hideki Nomo was the first one to do that, right? First
yeah.
place from Japan.
Uh-huh.
And then it just set the standard. But what Ichiro did was he brought in humor. He talked about dream, the difference between a dream and a goal. And went down the line with some of his stats and had people in stitches. They were laughing. They were cracking up. And, of course, his wife is sitting there. That was the biggest honor that he gave to her. So I just thought that was a fabulous moment in baseball, watching him give a speech in the Hall of Fame, which is what everyone dreams of when they put on a baseball uniform, and in English. So, yeah, that was something worth it.
Yeah, that was a great speech, Robert. You're exactly right to bring that up. Delivered in English, not via translator. I think the reason that Ichiro stayed away from doing his own interviews for so long, that some of the adages or colloquialisms in English may not be portrayed the way he wanted to, and that's the reason why he went through a translator. But he speaks fluent English, and he speaks the language very well.
Yeah, these are things regular fans might not necessarily know, Bill, because we watch the game, and then we celebrate, and then we kind of want to hear them say something about it. And if we don't know that, what you just told us, then we're wondering what's going on. But, yeah, colloquialisms, it's hard. It's definitely hard, and especially in this day and age when there's so many Latin, you know.
Right. So many players don't speak English, a lot of these Latin players.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Were you telling me that the translator for the new Mets pitcher came out to the mound?
Yeah, Senga. Kodai Senga, the Japanese pitcher, has the translator come out with Jeremy Hefner when he's giving him a check or checking the status of how he's feeling. He brings the translator out with him.
Yeah. Okay. So I got to admit, if I'm getting paid more than like $20 a game, I would invest. Okay, I'd invest in someone to give me Berlitz, you know, so I learned English like real fast, and
yeah.
I don't need on the baseball field. Like, that's just me. I don't know.
Like the King's Speech, that movie when the guy teaches King George VI how really to publicly speak.
Yes.
That's what they need. A guy like Lionel.
You're right. Because, and what did he say when the King, one of my favorite movies, thank you for bringing it up, because it shows the difference between someone being timid, afraid, and stuttering in this case, and then once he conquers that fear, he walks out, the last scene of that movie, he walks out like a king.
Right.
He's standing tall. And what did, when the wife said, we'll see you next week, and the coach is like, no, we'll see you every day, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I would do. If I was in that position, if I went to a foreign place and I was making a lot of money in their, you know, in their language and their culture, that would be my motivation, would be to learn everything so that I could blend it. Actually, you know something? Mike Piazza was like that. Did you ever hear Piazza give an interview in Spanish?
No.
He is fluent in Spanish. I think he did one off season league in Mexico, and it was amazing, Bill. Look up on YouTube. I'm sure you could find Mike Piazza speaking Spanish. It was amazing. I mean, I'm not fluent, but I do understand Spanish. I could fake my way around. But nevertheless, I think that's, you know, that's something that you kind of should do. My estimation goes a little bit down when I hear about that. Someone's making, you know, major league money, at least on the baseball field. Okay, I want to take back what I said. In the locker room after the game, if that's your protocol, that's one thing. But out on the mound, I just feel that's a different animal there.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure Piazza's fluent in Italian, too, because he coaches the Italian national team. And I don't know if he still owns the football club over there, but he owned a soccer club, and he's got to speak Italian.
Yeah. Yes. I haven't heard him, but absolutely, I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure about that. But the thing was, like, I saw on Telemundo, one of these Spanish-speaking, and it's, you know, when you think about it, it would make sense even in the locker room, because the number of players who speak Spanish, you kind of want to hear what they say. I remember that was one of the problems that Willie Randolph had managing the Mets, was that a lot of the players spoke Spanish, and he didn't, the stars, you know, and he didn't know what they were saying. It's like, I'm the manager here. So I know we got to run here, Bill. So let me just do David Wright as the last one.
Sure. Go ahead, Robert. Yeah, Robert Begley with us tonight, author of Voices of Reason. And we'll talk about that quickly in a little bit. Give us David Wright.
So David Wright, I went a couple of months ago with my nephew to his absolute, induction to the Mets Hall of Fame. His number was retired, and this was a speech I was literally there for. So I was waiting to see how he would do. And I told my nephew, I was like, I give him a B minus kind of a plus. And I don't want to be really tough, but you have this opportunity here and everyone's going out to see you. The first mistake that I thought they made was he came out wearing a blazer. I want to see number 5. Okay, I want them to take off that number 5 jersey one more time before they put it up on their, they unveil it up at the top of the stadium. And that didn't happen. And then his speech was okay. I love David Wright. It's one of those things where I love, but I felt like, if I coached him, he would hit a home run. Okay, that's all I could say.
Yeah. I have to say also, Robert, my wife and I agree that the jackets for the Met Hall of Famers are pretty cheesy. I think Steve Cohen could have afforded something more than a Robert Hall jacket for these guys. maybe a Brooks Brothers jacket or something. But some of them look pretty pathetic in it. But that's a story for another day when we talk about fashion.
Now, it wanna... doesn't look good in it. David Wright doesn't look good in it.
Yeah, exactly. He was the only one. Now, I want to ask you, Robert, how Voices of Reason can help athletes and leaders?
Well, the way it can help them is understand how to give presentations. Sadly, Bill, most speeches are forgotten by the next day. So in my book, what I do is I focus on a couple of principles from some famous speeches throughout history, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr., Winston Churchill. And they spoke with a tone, with a confidence, and with an emotion that gripped their audiences and left legacy. So that's the way that I coach. I write about that in detail. And it's interesting because people have already started asking me about a follow-up book. And
sure,
I've coached leaders in history, and, okay, maybe athletes is the next one. Because I think it's really important. Athletes always have a microphone in front of them, so there's an opportunity for their voices to be heard. So instead of the cliches that rolls off their tongues, there's an opportunity there. Plus, you could start working on a second career while you're still healthy and not wait until your body's broken down and then you need to figure out a way to make ends meet after that. So that's a little bit of my thoughts on that.
I get you, Robert. Yeah, they need to come up with a little more than, I got my pitch, put a good swing on it, et cetera, and I'm just here to help the team win. We need something. We need something more than that. Than this canned stuff.
Yeah, you're totally right. You want to know one? Let me just say one last thing. David Ortiz. You never know how intelligent players are. So in 2004, when the Boston Red Sox finally beat the Red Sox, they asked him what he thinks about the rivalry. The Yankees and Red Sox rivalry. And Ortiz said something so insightful. He goes, now it's a rivalry. Now that when one team always beats the other, when it matters, that's not a rivalry. That's like a slaughter, So only when the Red Sox finally won, he's like, that's a rivalry. So even like little sentences like that in an interview, you're like, wow, that's really cool, So that's the power of the platform, if you know how to use it well.
I like the way you made an example of Aristotle's rhetoric meets modern sports moments. That's depicted in the book. That's pretty cool.
Absolutely. Yep. Ethos, logos, and pathos. That's it.
And that was great. How can athletes transitioning from athlete to retired speaker, how can they reach out to you or pick up the book, Robert?
So the book is number one on Amazon, Voices of Reason. Amazon Kindle in the meetings and presentations category, and speakingwithpurpose.llc is my website. You can find all the information, and my email is my name, robert@begley.com. That should be enough to start.
Wonderful. Well, Robert Begley, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for taking time out of your Sunday night to speak with us here on Sports Talk New York. Again, the folks, the book is titled Voices of Reason. And what's the other tag to the book, Robert? I can't find it right now.
It says Lessons for Liberty's Leaders. So if you want to be a leader, especially you're talking about the role of like personal freedom in your life, those are the leaders, Lincoln, Churchill, MLK. They talked about leadership, Patrick Henry. So those are like the role models for that category.
Wonderful. And as we said, folks, Amazon, that's a place to get it. Robert,
yes.
Thanks so much for coming on, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Absolutely. You take care.
That's Robert Begley, ladies and gentlemen. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my guests, Ray Burris and Robert Begley, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you guys for joining us. See you next on Sunday, September 28th, for more Sports Talk. Till then, be safe, be well. Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.